Okay, now on to our evening's lecture. Joined up thinking at the human interface. I'm as intrigued as anyone. I'm going to hand over to initially to Neil Harris of Highwave, and he's going to introduce the proceedings, and then he'll then lead us into the. It's a two-part lecture, and he'll lead us into James after that. So, Neil.
Those of you who've known me for longer than I dare care to remember. You'll notice the name change. The HI in Highwave is human interface, so this is right on what we're doing now. So audio is part of what, a big part of what we do still, but we're also looking at other things like haptics. It's a particular interest of mine. but this lecture, I'm going to spread it a bit wider than that, certainly at the beginning, and think about all the different ways that we sense things and how they interact. So that's what the implications for that is on how we design our hardware. So that's sort of a summary of where I'm going. So at the core of what I'm talking about is multimodal perception. And that's a scientific buzzword, just meaning receiving things on many channels. So that I'll go into that in a bit more detail in describing what it is. And then we can look at some of the little neat party tricks you can play by trading off one modality against another. Which leads in, if you like, the more central point of the talk, the fact that you need to get them all right and together and synchronized. Otherwise, you can get some unexpected things going on that aren't quite what you desired in the first place. I'll then sort of move on a little bit from sort of pure theory into designing interfaces in ways that human beings can communicate with machines. So I use the term human-computer interface, but I'm using computer in a very generic sort of sense. So a washing machine would be a computer. Nowadays, they're probably more intelligent than most of the people who use them, but it's still essentially a dumb machine that does one thing, but you still have an interface to it, make it do that one thing properly. And then I move on a bit to looking at how the fact that we're now trying to communicate over multimodal interface, what the design challenges are as a consequence of that, and how we get it right and not just bamboozle the user with lots of stuff and it's bored of it in 5 minutes and turns it off. I keep coming back to these two key things. Delays are very important, we've got to get that sussed. And everything seems supposed to come from the same position. If it doesn't work, the illusion's broken. Hence the co-location. I'm an estate agent joke. Okay, so I've cribbed some stuff, so it's not all my own ideas, which is probably just as well. This comes from Wikipedia, so that explains some of the grammar. So modality in human-computer interaction is just a general class of a sense through which the human can perceive output from the computer or the computer can sense input from the human. So it's a path of communication between the user, the human being, and the computer. And leads me fingers and ears and eyes and all sorts of bits and parts of the body that are designed for sensing can be involved in that. What gets interesting is when you are not just communicating through one of those channels, but through more than one at a time. So these can overlap. Sometimes you can have redundancy. So, for example, someone who can't see can still use the machine because they can hear the instructions, in which case it's said to have redundant modalities. Having too much information is not a smart idea. People just get bamboozled. However, you do need enough to make the job doable and accessible to a wide class of people. Right, so here are, again, this is, scientists like to name things. Here are the names of some of the major modalities. We have the seeing or vision modality, which is just your eyes, hearing, touch, which is tactile, and tactition, something to do with sensing pressure, essentially not just with necessarily the fingertips, but in our case, primarily with the fingertips. and a general sense of knowing with where you are relative to the rest of the world, proprioception, and other things like taste and sense, and the old one about having smell of vision, and the cooking programs, it's a long way off, I guess. Hot and cold, pain, balance, all these things. And one thing, these are sort of fairly distinct terms, but actually things get a bit messy. And for example, there's the old trick that shows how taste and smell are linked, where you get someone who has their nose picked to try and tell the difference blindfolded between a piece of apple and a piece of onion, and most people can't do it, which is quite surprising. Tasting with your nose unpicked is blatantly obvious. Okay, so let's try and make some sense of all this. The science of psychophysics, which is basically analysing the perceptual processes by studying the effect on a subject's experience or behaviour of systematically varying the properties of a stimulus along one or more physical dimensions. Basically means how we perceive the physical world. So we need, so it's a multidisciplinary approach. You need the psychology to understand the human part of it, and you need the engineering to understand the computer part of it, or the physics part of it. And one thing that is sort of central to the whole thing, the whole of psychophysics actually, is that the human is always right by definition. Therefore, just because you don't understand it doesn't mean that it's wrong. And that can be quite frustrating for people like engineers and programmers who like to have things very precise and ordered and have numbers and things. You talk to a psychologist about thresholds of hearing, they go, it's somewhere about there. And you talk to an engineer and they say it's so many decibels. So this is my own opinion. Science is a bit of a reductionist tendency. We like just to try and understand things by separating and dividing them down to simple systems. Human perception, as I mentioned earlier, things are rarely that simple. So you have all your senses, your vision, your touch, your hearing, all providing information about your environment. And with all these different bits of information coming, we've got to try and produce a coherent internal model of the world around us. Both, it's not just a static thing, this is a dynamic thing that changes with time and its position, and has sort of steady state behaviours and transient behaviours. So for example, we are much more sensitive to things that move than things that don't. So if people sit still for a very long time and I sit still for a very long time, then we won't be able to see each other. At least that's the theory. So the point is that you have to merge all these different sources of information into one internal model. And that can involve all sorts of strategies. Some of it's physiological, it's done in the body. Some of it's neurological, it's sort of done somewhere between the sensor and the brain. Some of it's definitely cognitive. It's done in the higher processes of the brain. So trying to produce simple models of it tends to come up against a brick wall at some point and doesn't fit reality because it makes too many assumptions. But because of all this interconnectedness, we get what's called cross-modal interaction. So this is, again, the onion and the apple. The sense of smell lets you separate them, but without it, you can't tell the difference. So the two senses together are more powerful than one on its own. Yet, this is the Wikipedia definition of psychophysics, which is quite long. And a couple of other definitions, a broadsheet definition might be that it's all about perception and subjective experience. Tabloid definition is all about me. Actually, when it comes to perceiving things, the brains are quite naive and gullible. They have to work in real time. And there's a sort of fairly slow chemical processes. That means they play every trick in the book to make you think they're a lot faster than they really are. What this generally means is that we assume things are like the way we expect them to be unless something compelling tells us that it's otherwise. Because of this, we can deliberately trick one sense by using another to disguise what's going on. And there's a well-known example of the interesting Susan. I suppose we've got an internet connection. does it actually work? But go and look at it, you find it on YouTube. Basically what you see is a video of a chap mouthing a syllable repeatedly, and you're invited to listen to it. Listen to it again with your eyes closed, and then listen to it with the audio turned off. And the thing is, you get three different perceptions of what the guy's saying, which is really quite interesting. So yes, it's quite a well-known effect. But it just shows that you've got this interactivity going on between what you see, what you hear, and it's quite complicated. It's not. Yeah, another trick, it's one I read off recently. If you rub your hands together, you get a characteristic sound. You can play tricks by masking that sound and playing the wrong sound back. If you play a low-pass filtered version of it, you get the distinct feeling your hands have suddenly gone clammy. It's difficult to demonstrate to a large audience. Just put some earplugs in and do it. It has a similar effect. And it's a variation of the theme, just drawing on a board with a bit of chalk and seeing how different it feels when you can't hear the horrible noise it's making. So so we can trick the brain into thinking it's feeling one thing when it's actually feeling something else just by changing the sound it makes. So here we have an interaction between the sense of touch and the sense of sound, which is exactly where playing to our strengths really. So I'm going to do a bit about synchronization now. Two senses, especially temporal synchronization, perhaps the one that comes immediately to mind. Yes, let's talk about forming an internal worldview. Our worldview is based on experience, and in our experience, things that make sound, what you see and what you hear are co-located. They come from the same thing at the same time. The action of my bringing this down on the table makes the noise, and I can see it when it hits the table. So we expect these things to be in synchrony with each other. And if that's not the case, if that synchrony breaks too much, we start to disassociate the event. So we see the tap and we hear the sound and think it must be something else because it didn't come from there. And that can be very confusing. Perhaps a simple everyday example is when they get the lip sync wrong on TV programs. I had a couple of bad examples of it on iPlayer recently where there were several seconds delay between the video and the audio. Stop it and start again. Quite amusing for a few seconds and then it gets boring. apparently, with all the sort of digital processing going on in TVs nowadays, it's quite a bit of a headache to keep the two in sync, especially when you don't know how long it's going to take at the other end. There is an EBU recommendation on what that timing difference, what the thresholds are of that that are acceptable for the transmission. Unless it's asymmetrical, we are more sensitive to advanced audio than we are to retarded audio. It's quite common. The speed of hearing is not the same as the speed of seeing. But at each sort of stage of the reproduction, you've got to keep those delays quite small, otherwise they just build up and become unsustainable. Here we are. It's this is a summary of some research that was done back in 93, so this is a way back. Someone's done an analysis on how much delay can you have before people start noticing it, and what are the effects that they describe when they start noticing it. So the first one is that, perhaps interesting, there's this tie-in between, if you analyse it as an engineer, you might say, oh, there's bad lip sync. But the subjective response is that the person speaking is somehow not as interesting, or not as pleasant, or perhaps he's not quite got it together, which is interesting. So this is playing on something, an internal feeling rather than sort of something analytical that you can detect. Funny enough, there's no effect on the memory, so you can laugh at it because you can cope with it, but it's just not very pleasant. And another thing, there are sort of two separate thresholds. One is this five frame threshold, where the respondents could accurately say that they were not in sync. But from about 2.5 out of sync, they were starting to report some of these negative psychological things. So they hadn't noticed that it was out of sync in a conscious way, but they obviously had in a subconscious way because it was affecting their perceptions. It's my bold. So 2.5 fields, that's assuming 20 milliseconds a field, that's only about 50 milliseconds, which is about the numbers that the EBU talking about. So this is the other type of synchronization, spatial synchronization. So again, if I tap this on the desk, then the noise comes from over there. The illusion is broken, okay? It's not this that's making the noise, it must be something else. And so if we're trying to reproduce the illusion of this banging on the desk, but our loudspeaker's over there, then it's not going to work. You know, the loudspeaker needs to be where the thing is that's supposed to be making the noise. Or at least it's got to sound like it's where the thing is that's making the noise, which is not necessarily the same thing. And the University of Dresden, Technical University of Dresden, have done a lot of work on the basic psychophysics of touch and how it links particularly to audio. So there's an effect. And Erkan and Otis always done presentations at the AES, a number of times back in the UK last year and the year before, I think. And in an experiment where he had a tactile response, basically someone rubbing their fingers over some rough paper, and a sound was reproduced over an arc of hidden loudspeakers, and they found that the two only had to be out by just about 5 degrees, and people started noticing that it wasn't coming from the right place. So we have all these interactions, and that if we're trying to produce an illusion that is multisensory, then we've got to get them in the same place at the same time, otherwise it isn't going to work. So moving on, okay, so this is back to the practical applications of what we're talking about. This is like a traditional human-computer interface design. I said earlier that science is a reductionist tendency. It's also seen amongst engineers who like to build sort of nice little systems that do one job and do it well, and then work out how to make them talk to each other afterwards. And so we have a keyboard with a mechanical input, we have a mouse, we have a visual display, we have some audio around here somewhere, touchscreen, I don't know if it's got a touchscreen, but it could be a touchscreen, and maybe some sort of haptic feedback or something. And all these elements that tend to be autonomous and mutually ignorant, and it's up to the poor old software, the operating system, to try and choreograph all these different effects and wizards into something coherent. It's fine. So what's good about that? Well, actually, there are some good things about it. One of the big issues with human-computer interface is feedback. People like to know that the machine has heard them, otherwise they get very frustrated. Conventional input device like a keyboard or a mouse, you've got instant visual and haptic feedback from the device itself. You push the button, you see it move, you hear the click as it goes through the selection point. Same with the mouse, it moves, it clicks, you've got some idea of where it is with respect to you. So they naturally provide a certain amount of, like the first level feedback, the fact that it is actually responding to your input. Next level, has the machine actually taken any notice of what I've told it to do? That's a separate issue. But at least the hardware part of the interface tells you that it's working. Because of the more modern interfaces where you have a touch screen, you don't have those cues, they're not there. Does anybody actually like the feel of the memory and keypad? Most people don't use laptop trackpads if they can possibly help it. being a little mouse, not I do, certainly. So, you know, if we make all our interfaces completely virtual, so that your only means of communicating is via this touch interface with no intrinsic feedback, then how does the device let you know that it's even noticed you exist? Not everything was good in the old days. So has this ever happened to you? Editing a nice union document, say word processor, you press a button, you get the click. So yes, I've pushed the button, the machine doesn't seem to have heard me. Maybe it wasn't listening. Let's do it again. Click. Oh, it heard me. Oh dear, it's done it twice. I deleted the whole document. So the moral of the story is there's more to feedback than just clicks and buzzes. And it's certainly at least in reduction of syncing, it operates on two levels. First, we need to know that the input device is working. I don't have to thump this screen to make it hear me. It has heard me. But secondly, we need to know that actually the machine's listening to the interface device and has said, yes, okay, I'm going to do that for you now. If you don't give feedback, then people find your device difficult to use. But if you give feedback that's contradictory and confusing, they just get fed up with it and just don't trust any of it. The machine's broken. I had an interesting conversation with Soren Beck from B&K. So they tried to replace a control system for a CD player with a touch screen and a really nice sort of industrial design piece. But because there's like a finite time, it takes a finite time for a CD mechanism to eject, people were getting very frustrated because they pushed the thing, nothing would happen. So they push it again, and the thing would go. So they actually they replaced it with a physical button that went click when you pressed it, so people knew that it was responding to their touch. So it gets us all, not just the guys at Microsoft and Apple. So today, our human machine interfaces are mostly restricted to visual, possibly auditory feedback. Depending on your task, maybe there's just so much information coming at you that there's no room for anything else. Some of these tactical displays used by military, civilian air traffic control systems, you've got big screens, lots of information, buzzing, noise and stuff going on. They need to know if two aircraft are getting too close together, and they need to know it quickly. And there's been quite a lot of research done on using tactile feedback to parts of the body that simulates the tap on the shoulder, for example. And we instinctively respond to that in the right direction. And they're using it to pull the operator's attention to the thing that's important. Collision warning or exocet coming in from the left. So they can deal with the thing that is really important very quickly. So people are starting to explore what can be communicated through the sense of touch. And conversely, the sense of touch, is significantly enhanced by audio and force feedback cues. Again, an AES presentation done by a gentleman from Audi Group. Someone apparently has measured the force characteristics and sounds of something like 10,000 different tactile switches and has a database of them. They know exactly what sound and what force feedback you need for, say, a Mercedes, so that the user thinks this is a really expensive device and what you can get away with for, say, a Fiat, and people don't care what it's like, but actually it might be the same physical device. Makes you think. But just what the tricks that we can play just by getting the sound right and the feel right, it's completely changed people's perception. And we've seen a bit, the visual side, perhaps Apple coming along with nice, sexy interfaces that people more intuitively interact with, and took some of the cumbersome Windows stuff and menus and stuff that you get in Windows and Unix and other such operating systems. They're going to be similar sort of learning curves for tactile feedback. So even simple tasks like when you write on a piece of paper, there's a sound that follows your movements. And the demonstration at a Hague convention actually with a simulated pencil sound on a tactile playback, and one of the women who tried it, she's a researcher into multimodal communication, particularly for disabled people, but she said, "I feel like I'm being more creative." You know, psychologist speak. She's a psychologist, not an engineer. But just by providing that extra feedback cue, it meant that she didn't have to concentrate so much on what she was doing from a mechanical point of view, and she could think about what she was doing from an artistic point of view. And so she felt more creative in using it. Very subtle things, very slight vibration, very slight buzz, but it made all the difference to the perception. Just touching a piece of glass isn't particularly appealing. You want things to respond to you so that you know that you've touched them. I guess as the touchscreen becomes more and more ubiquitous, with more and more sort of finger-based and pen-based input, people are going to want tactile feedback to help them, guide them in their use of these devices. Otherwise, they're just really difficult. You have to concentrate so much just to get the data input done. And various, again, psychological testing. People have shown that you can speed up data entry and reduce numbers of errors and improve safety in mission-critical applications by applying these extra modalities of feedback, touch or audio. And it increases people's confidence in using the equipment. And I suppose when economics drives everything, if you get some positive feedback from your input device, you don't need great big buttons that you know that you've hit. You put your fist on it, a little button that says, "Yes, you touched me, yes, you touched me." Get away with squeezing things down smaller, which pleases people. But actually, multimodal feedback is particularly valuable for those who are challenged in one or more of their senses. So that doesn't matter whether that's a clinical disability, such as blindness or deafness. You're just getting on with it, and it doesn't work quite as well as it used to when you were younger. For example, they've used acoustic and tactile feedback alongside one of these virtual keyboards, and they show that you take an average across many people, sort of 30 to 40% improvement in accurate throughput generally achieved with those cues. But if you look at the data for older people, it tends to be towards the higher end of that, maybe 50-60% in some cases, particularly as you get up towards the 70s and 80s. But the individual sensing modalities are deteriorating through age, so having the extra input is really valuable to them. So you're making your hardware more accessible to more people, providing better feedback. Using communication between people who can see and people who can't see through a tactile interface. There's all stuff, interesting stuff going on in colleges. On another sort of non-computer application in cinemas, where the low frequency effects channel is fed through seats into seats, and obviously there's the vibration and all the wow of it, and it's probably too much because everybody likes to know that they're feeling the effect. Even when it's sort of turned down to something a bit more subtle, one of the perceived effects is that the low frequency sound is louder, which it isn't if you put a DV meter and they're exactly the same. In fact, it could possibly be quieter because you don't need to blast the air to try and shake them, and so you get a gentle shake from underneath. And that's found using particularly places where they have sound limit regulations to contend with when you're going to play it loud. A bit of vibration does a lot to make up for the lack of dBs. But the suggestion perhaps for our industries is that we could perhaps provide subjectively better bass reproduction from small handheld devices just by letting them vibrate it for a tricking the ears into thinking that they're hearing something that they're not. Here's some notes from Nokia. Anybody from Nokia here? Found this on the web. I didn't steal it on this. Can't even read it. So it pretty sums up what I said. Audio feedback is useful for the user, especially in touch devices. But yeah, don't overdo it. A little helps, but too much doesn't. It distracts. Again, vibration and tactile feedback is useful. Again, don't overdo it. Don't buzz through everything, otherwise people just get fed up with it and turn it off. And you've got to tie these things in together, so if you've got audio feedback, tactile feedback, visual feedback, they should all make sense together. There should be a unifying style that makes sense. And you push the button, it appears to go in, you hear the click and you feel the thump. All those things need to work together. So there's a... So again, there's a latency involved, about 10 to 20 milliseconds between what you do and getting the feedback. If it's much more than that, people start to notice the delay. You can use audio and feedback together, but the two should be synchronized. If there's a noticeable delay, then make sure they're delayed by the same amount, so at least they sound consistent with each other. So that's all from Nokia. So how close do these things have to be? Well, we've already seen for the audio visual, it took them to plus 40, minus 60 milliseconds. For tactile auditory link, we're talking more like 25 milliseconds, depending on how you do the measurement and what the sound, what the vibration and sound sources are. These things vary a little bit. But what's quite stunning is that some studies show extremely low threshold values, particularly for people who have some musical training. Down as low as 10 milliseconds and they start to notice that there's a delay. Suggesting requirement for 10 millisecond audio, tactile, maximum synchronization error for virtual reality environments. And what's perhaps interesting is the subjective and objective point of simultaneity don't coincide. The objective simultaneity means it's 0 milliseconds between them. if you ask someone to judge when they are coincident in time, they, on average, will come that the audio is actually 7 milliseconds ahead of the haptics. This is different times it takes for us to process those sensory inputs. So, yes, again, in our sort of everyday situations, whether it's doing with playing a piano, writing text, or we touch things interactively, and the action of touching causes audio and tactile feedback. So we've learnt that these things are linked and they're related and they happen simultaneously. But conversely, when we hear or when we sense things that are coincident, we tend to associate them with the same event. So it's really, if we are trying to simulate a single event, then it is important that all our feedback modalities are within these fairly small millisecond, 10 millisecond, 20 millisecond type delays of each other. Otherwise, the illusion doesn't work. However, it isn't just the hardware we have to contend with. Again, this is a quote from a study done on 4 different mobile phone type devices. And they showed, they had a set up to measure, so they could actually video someone pressing the button and they could measure the forces and record the sound, and so they could get objective measurements of what the delays between the different things were. And what they found was not only did you have differences between the devices, which you might well expect, but there were differences between different applications running on one device. And by different channels, you know, maybe a different delay between for the audio and for the haptics and for the video. So it's, you've got all the software layer in the way as well that you have to deal with. And again, time and integrity, we also need spatial integrity. If you can tell the difference between sound and a feeling that are only 5 degrees apart, then it's no good trying to reproduce keyboard click here with a loudspeaker that's on your desk over there. It's just not going to work. Maybe with two and a bit of careful steering, you can give some sort of release that's coming from the middle somewhere. But you know, it'd be better if it was sort of, it sounded like it was coming from where your finger's pressing. That's what you really want. So you've had this challenge. How do we produce this convincing assemblage of audio, visual, and haptic clues from the same place at the same time? And if we need temporal synchrony of better than 25 milliseconds, we can't rely on the poor old operating system to do it. It's just, it can't respond in that sort of time frame, which means that the I/O devices are going to have to start talking to each other. So we need a way for the input devices to acknowledge that the message has been received and passed on to the machine. And that's got to happen within 20 milliseconds. And if you've got a machine that can take anywhere between 100 and 500 milliseconds to get around to it, people have given up and gone home by then. It's just no good. So what do we need? What we need is joined up thinking. Imagine we have a device with a touch-sensitive screen. On the screen is a keyboard, a simulated mouse, perhaps, with icons that initiate actions, icons that can be moved around. You can imagine the device can give audio and haptic feedback as well as video. The device is smart. It knows where you're touching it before the operating system does. And being really smart, it can tell whether you're just dithering, you're sort of waving your finger around, haven't really decided what to do yet, or you have decided what you're going to do. Yes, I want that to happen. It can tell because it's smart. It knows that on some of those touches, it's got to respond instantly. And can provide it. It knows in other cases it's got to wait for the operating system and wait for it. Being really user-friendly, it can let the user know that the input was noted and the machine is busy thinking about it. It says, you know, come up with the coffee cup symbol. This is before the operating system has even noticed that it's been asked to do anything. Never mind when it's finished getting around from the last virus update that's delayed it for 3 seconds or whatever. This is what I mean by joined up thinking. So all your hardware interfaces are keeping in contact with each other, so they all have a picture of roughly what's going on. They can provide what's needed straight away, they can provide it straight away and keep the operating system updated with what's going on, but not rely on it to tell them how to do everything. Now, this is a bit of a utopian dream. What do we need to make it happen? In the first place, we can integrate some of the systems as well. In iWave, we talk about audio and haptics. Having these in the same place makes it much easier to ensure that haptics and audio cues are spatially and temporally coincident. And it also means that we can provide hi-fi haptics by having wide bandwidth transducers that don't just go brr, brr, brr to everything. You can have different tactile responses depending on what you're doing, whether you're clicking a button or dragging something or you're moving a fader type control. You have different feedbacks that are appropriate for whatever it is you're doing. Perhaps we should talk to the touch sensor so that we can keep those delays down to a minimum. We know where we are. All the subsystem suppliers are trying to do this. So you see people with touchpads starting to talk to people who do touch sensors. Everyone's noticing we've got to start to integrate these things if we're going to make it work. Even if system manufacturers aren't going to buy everything from one place, there's still this. We would like to at least try and make the granulation a little bit coarser than it is at present. And in second place, these systems can start to communicate with each other. The example I just gave, that our haptics makes use of the position about the touch location so that it knows where to send the haptic response and the audio cue. Now we could sit around and wait for the operating system to get around to telling us that, but I suspect by then it'd be too late. So if we just sort of piggyback on the touch sensor and say, hey, can you give us a heads up of what's going to happen? But we're ready for it so that when it's needed, it can come. So all we need for that to happen is for there to be some industry standards on data passing. And in the third place, we can, you know, the systems themselves can start to be smarter, and they can know whether they're supposed to be operating in real time to give instant feedback, or whether this really doesn't matter. We can wait for the operating system to get around to it, make those distinctions. So, summary. It's all about perception and subjective experience. The human is always right. Vision, touch, audition, and other senses provide us with information about the environment, and the information from all these senses is put together into a coherent picture of the world surrounding us. These different modalities interact and can either reinforce or confuse, depending on whether they're agreeing or disagreeing with each other, and their consistency. In most daily life situations, we touch objects actively, and this action causes both audio and tactile feedback. So we've learned that these things are related and usually happen at the same time, the same events. We've also had a history, that's a history of science and engineering, is to separate things and boil them down to simple stuff. So we tend to concentrate on one mode or one simple system at a time. However, even so, some of these devices, which are principally unimodal, actually communicate back to us through models. So the mouse, you push a button, actually you see it move, you hear it click, and you feel the response. So it's actually communicating back on three different channels, even though it's actually designed just to do the one. Clever people design them so that those feedbacks are good as well. It's a big difference between a cheap mouse and an expensive one. So our modern interfaces need to think wider. We have the sense of touch being enhanced significantly by audio enforced feedback. Without these extrasensory feedbacks touching glass surfaces, it's a bit macro-y, doesn't tell you what's going on. Most touch technologies fail to provide these natural feedback. It can make it difficult. Slow, deliberate thing and just checking, looking at the screen all the time to make sure the computer's actually, is my finger in the right place? This gets quite difficult to use. With just a little bit extra feedback and guiding would be much easier to use. Co-location in time and space are essential if the different modalities are to properly integrate. And these are quite tight tolerances. We're talking about 10 to 20 milliseconds audio tactic, 50 milliseconds audio visual. Perhaps, some people can detect these are average thresholds. People who are good at it can do it a lot better than that. So if you want to fool everyone, you've got to be much better than these numbers. It's 10 milliseconds for a musician. And spatial separations are just over 5 degrees, quite detectable. So the challenge then is to provide a convincing assemblage of audio, visual and haptic cues in the same place at the same time. We can't rely on the operating system to do this because it's just not operating on the same real time that we're talking about here. Its latencies are too long and too variable. What we need is smart interfaces that integrate functionality, that talk to each other so that time critical events can be acted on quickly. We need joined up.
Thank you. I'm going to have to wander about a bit because I want to try and demonstrate one or two things. I'm not a scientist and I'm not an engineer, but I wanted to try and sort of put in context some of this joined up thinking at a business level as well. And I also wanted to take the opportunity of giving a little bit more understanding of where HiWave came from, because I'm going to guess here, this is my very first time at an AES event. I know Neil's turned up many times over the years, and I guess most of you other chaps have, so you've probably heard a progression of Neil's input on some of the technology behind what was NXT, the old NXT, where back in the 90s somebody stood up in a big building in London and said, this is the future, and made all sorts of things, make all sorts of noises, and people went out and bought a vast amount of shares in the business. Well, the harsh reality is that it's a very different business, some decade and a half on, from how it was then. The company set itself up to license its technology. When you license, you get your scientists and your clever people to stand up in front of customers and say, here's how it works, here's the theory, here's what our patents enable. And then the sales guy in the suit says, okay, you know it all, go off, invent stuff, and then send me royalty checks at the end of every month, and we'll all get rich. Problem is, technology often is difficult to pull together into real-life applications. NXT had visions that everything would be turned into loudspeakers and you know, the old cone speakers of many years ago. Well, cone speakers of today. Yeah, so it didn't quite work, did it? But the technology still is good and is sound. And I don't know whether any of you are sort of up to date, but I'll wander over to this side and just see. What I'm doing here, because I'm not an audio engineer, I'm not an audio engineer, that's for sure, but my background for the last N years, how do I make this work? Do I just touch that? Yes, I do. Is as a chip person. I've spent the last 25 years in the world of semiconductors. And in the world of semiconductors, we define systems. And we say, we've got to have a bit of processing engine there, you've got to have some memory, and you've got to be able to do the clocks and all that other kind of stuff. Oh, and some signals in and some signals out. And then we draw a box around it, and we say, hey, that looks like a system on the chip, because you can do wonders with a bit of silicon these days. What can't you do with silicon? Silicon is king. It's what everything is all about. System on a chip. And then we make something that looks like that. And we say, look, there we are. We've got a million transistors on something that's half a centimeter across. What can't we do? There's a certain amount of ignorance and possibly a little bit of arrogance that comes out of the semiconductor industry. You know, people have made their billions of dollars in the world of semiconductors, and they strut their stuff. But I challenge it a little bit. And I think we should be looking at the ecosystem. And the ecosystem goes beyond the electronic system. And it takes into account sensors and actuators. It's the transducers. Because without those, without an understanding of those, well, what on earth are you doing in the middle? What is it you're actually trying to achieve? And almost every system, as we've just been talking about, human interface, inputs, outputs, how you get something into, how you communicate with the device, it's all dependent on transducers, the input sensors and the output actuators. And this is something that has really, I think, sort of occurred to me and sort of become quite deeply entrenched in my vision and my view of businesses like ours, in industries like ours now. If you move away from that, you know, I'm the chip guy and therefore I'm master of this universe, and you say, well, actually, should we be looking more at the ecosystem? Does it allow us to do a better job? And I think the answer is yes. And I think we can really address that in terms of both the performance of your overall system, ecosystem, and its cost, and the cost that ultimately the consumer will pay. So in our little world, it's mostly the output transducers. Neil talked a bit about tactile feedback and haptics and things, but I'll come back more to audio because it's an audio event and it's a little bit more fun actually. And our ecosystem is something that makes the noise and something that causes whatever that thing is to make the noise. It's a fairly simple ecosystem, but we've brought the whole lot under control. And the way we did that was to go from that licensing model where we'd say, here's some theories, you can actually do calculations where you can work out on a panel where and how and what sort of energy to put in, and a lot of theory, go off and do it, Mr. Customer, to our own intellectual property in our own products that we can then sell to customers. I like the word sell because generally it's got sort of money attached to it. If you can make some money, then you can run a business, and if you can run a business, you can employ people, and then you can do more things and grow the business and all happily ever after. So what we've done to be a bit more joined up than ever before, and really what marks the transition from old NXT to new Highwave, is to bring some semiconductor technology alongside some transducer. And these are just examples. This is a chip here that was created to convert electricity into audio signals out to a speaker, with almost none of it being turned into heat. Amplifiers are n percent efficient because the 1 minus n becomes heat. And by using some very clever design techniques, we've managed to convert almost no electricity into heat, which means it all goes into the audio device. And instead of making cardboard boxes into sound and then wondering, well, have I got too much sellotape on it, or if I took Amazon off and put Sainsbury's on, might it sound a bit better? We've actually taken the technology down into components. So the black thing on the right looks a little bit like what we'd recognise as a loudspeaker. We call it a balanced mode radiator. It's a flat panel. It's a piece of cardboard box with an exciter behind it, and a few bits of rubber and balancing masses and things, and it turns the panel into a pretty good loudspeaker. I can show you some progression of that as well. So I think the point I'm trying to get across is that when we've got that interface known, then we can actually go to a new level on optimization at both ends. And you can start to explore ever cleverer ways of generating sound in the transducers, and ever better ways of managing that sound in the chip. When you know what's happening with one, and you can actually generate some feedback from a transducer back into the chip. What can you do if you start to be able to understand what's happening in the voice coil of a speaker? And it's difficult to do those when, most speaker drivers are made in factories in China, and an awful lot of amplifiers are made in by companies like Texas Instruments, who are in Texas, and they're half a world apart. Bring these under one roof, and you can start to take it to a new level. And that's where we're at with Highwave. We haven't got all the answers right now, but we've actually got a big opportunity, the avenue ahead of us, to be able to do ever greater optimization at transducers and at semiconductors. And that's going to then spread back out into the human interface that Neil was talking about. So we are going to see the transducer and electronics coming together to be able to create tactile feedback from handheld devices, mobile phones and tablets and things like that, and audio out of the same transducers. So we've changed the company quite a bit. And why are we doing that? What you should be thinking about as a business is to get the best that you possibly can out there to the biggest customer base, where you're going to make some money. Right now, this is quite important, this world of audio. Listening habits are changing. There are very few people going into stores now to buy a piece of equipment that allows them to sit just in the right place with speakers in just the right place and settle down and listen properly. They're up, down, in, out, wandering from room to room, standing up, sitting down, making a cup of tea or whatever, and they want to get the best sound in that living environment. And that's changing the way audio system manufacturers are going about designing and developing their products. So the benefits really come back to bringing simplicity to that whole process in three key areas. One is cost, and it's the cost of doing it and the cost that it enables you to deliver to your customers. Time to market is key. We're in ever shorter design cycles where the day after Thanksgiving matters such a lot that if you haven't got something in pre-production by about August or something like that, you're going to miss it and wait a whole year till next year. Design cycles get squished. So the race means that if you've if you've got an overall solution that you can deliver somebody, get him ahead of his competitors, then he'll jump at it. And the resources that it takes to do it, and resources what costs money in your company, and small companies are spending an awful lot of money on an awful lot of people, and you enable yourself to be more effective through a greater level of knowledge. You're just much more focused. So in our business, it's allowing us to go out and interface with customers. You can walk into John Lewis's up the road on Oxford Street, and you can buy these things now. That's got four of these in it.
I think if anybody would like to obviously have a bit of a closer look, I think that's okay, James. But we'll call the main meeting to a close and say thank you very much once again. Thank you.